Hello and welcome. This is the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. A little later, Tim Dennis will join me for more dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Joining us right now, Troy Taylor is the author of more than 120 books covering everything from ghosts and hauntings to true crime, the unexplained, and the supernatural in America. He's also the founder of American Hauntings, Inc., which offers books, ghost tours, events, and weekend excursions. He was born and raised in the Midwest and currently divides his time between Illinois and the far-flung reaches of America. He's here to talk to us about his new book that just came out this year, I Want to Come Home Tonight, The Haunting Story of Marion Parker. Troy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
I've got to ask you, I mean, it's interesting to me that I'm finding more and more of my paranormal friends are so into true crime as well. Why do you think there's this mix and acceptance of both?
Well, I think for me anyway, and even this story in particular, I started off, you know, always been interested in the unexplained and the mysterious and the unsolved, especially. And there were so many crimes that I began looking into. I mean, many, many years ago, my great grandfather was a police officer and has sort of always instilled in me all these weird stories that were cop stories and ghost stories. So I find that a lot of those crossed over, but then I kept finding so many crime stories, just general crime stories that you would never expect, that had sort of a supernatural aspect to it. You know, when you talk about ghosts and haunted places, you're often talking about unfinished business and violent events. And I mean, I think we've just described an awful lot of crimes right there. And I think that because of the events that take place, you know, a lot of them leave hauntings behind, and it's a nice mix. I mean, I started an entire series of books, the Dead Men Do Tell Tales series, that is nothing but a mixture of crime and ghost stories. I mean, and people just really, it's become like the most popular series of books that I do.
Right. We started with the show, of course, doing just paranormal. And once in a while, we would cross over and we would come upon some of these true crime stories that had a haunting angle to it outside of just the inhumanity of the murder or crime that took place. And we noticed that we were getting more downloads of the true crime aspect than we were of the natural paranormal show. And people, Tim and I weren't sure how our listeners would receive true crime on a paranormal show. And the response was overwhelming, so much so we now do 5 days a week with Beyond the Darkness. And then we have the additional show of True Crime Tuesday. And people love when we can cross both of them in this show. You know, it's fascinating enough just to hear how weird and bizarre the world is with true crime. But when you've got some of these haunting stories crossing over, and I want to talk about your new book. But real quickly, I know we've covered this story in the past on our show, both the paranormal show and on True Crime Tuesday. But one of your favorite stories deals with the Villisca Axe Murder House. And
yeah, it is. It's one of my favorites. You're right.
That is such a strange story and such a haunting aftermath. I have heard, truthfully, I have to say, some of the most terrifying, chilling EVP coming from that house from people I know and respect, which, and I'm sure you've heard it, the one that sounds like somebody's hitting something with a hammer and you just hear screams and pleading for stop. It is heart-wrenching, you know, to hear this kind of thing. All these years later, Troy, this house still seems to have activity. Can you give our audience that are new just a little taste of what happened in Villisca, Iowa?
Yeah, in June of 1912, the night of June 9th, someone broke into a house right on the edge of town, a little farmhouse on the edge of town, that belonged to a man named J.B. Moore, and he lived there with his family, and they had a couple of overnight guests in the house. Someone broke into the house and slaughtered, and I mean slaughtered, the entire family, left the axe murder, the weapon behind, and just disappeared. To this day, it's never been solved. The crime still stands out as the deadliest mass murder in Iowa history. And, you know, after all this time, there's still the mystery of what happened, why were the Moors targeted, and that's a whole other thing. I did an entire book on this particular case because as I was researching it, I kept finding matching murders a string of them all the way across the Midwest leading up to Villisca, and then a couple that took place afterward that were absolutely identical to the Villisca murders. I mean, right down to the way that the crime scene was set up with lanterns, with lights that were turned down to the wicks, and all kinds of, every single thing was identical, and no one had ever really picked this up before. And I realized that the Moores were murdered by a serial killer before we knew what serial killers were. But anyway, beside that story, that the house in Villisca has had a reputation for being extremely haunted over the last 105 years. And it's one of the places I may have visited numerous times. And it's a place that when people ask me, you know, you write about this stuff, but has any of this stuff really happened to you? And I can always point to the Villisca house and say, yeah, this is a place where I really had some actual experiences. And it is, I believe, one of the most haunted places in the entire country.
There was a strange case a few years ago talking about true crime. Didn't somebody, a paranormal investigator, either stab themselves or someone else at the Villisca Axe murder house?
Well, they stabbed themselves. I don't know. I can't. I don't want to speak to that because I don't know all the details. But I don't think it was a case of anybody being possessed by ghosts or anything. I think it was something that happened that an attention kind of thing. And I think there's a lot more to that story, I think, than just got what got reported. I think, you know, when you hear, oh, somebody, you know, stabbed and injured at the Villisca Axe murder house, you assume the worst. And I think the whole thing was kind of blown out of proportion.
Well, I'll tell you what, we definitely have to have you back. You've piqued my interest. I've got to get the book on the Villisca Axe murder house from you, since you take a different perspective and stretch this out outside of the one story into
it's not just a string of
murders. We'll definitely have to have you back here in a month or so, maybe for the month of October. It'd be a great time to visit with you and do a true crime story on that, since there is so much paranormal activity, and this may be tied to a much larger string of serial murder. Fascinating stuff. Let's get into your new book, though. I Want to Come Home Tonight, sure. The Haunting Story of Marion Parker. How did this story come to your attention?
Well, that was funny because we were just talking about how this stuff crosses over. And this story, you know, I was aware of it. I knew about the story because it's one of those, I mean, it's probably one of the most horrific kidnapping cases in California history, and buddy, that's saying a lot for California.
Right.
They've got some really heinous stuff that goes on out there, but this was a bad one. And so I was familiar with the story, but I didn't put it together with any ghost stories until, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I was going through some stuff and looking into some, you know, different reports of haunted houses, and I came across this house where this woman had reported that it was haunted, and she believed that it was haunted by the ghost of a little girl, and they had seen her in the house, and, you know, some things had happened and lights turn on and off and things like that. Well, they noted that one night in December that all of a sudden every light in the house suddenly went off all by itself, and nobody could explain it, that no switches had been thrown, no circuits had been blown, nothing like that. And the lights just all went off, stayed off for a few minutes, and came right back on again as if nothing had ever happened. And she didn't realize that at the time that the anniversary of when this happened was the anniversary of the day that Marion Parker disappeared and was murdered. And I guess what's funny about it is she also didn't know is that they lived in the old Parker house. That was what got my attention to the story. And I thought, This is interesting, because I'd never heard a paranormal aspect to this already horrific story before. But a lot of people aren't familiar with it that don't live in California or the LA area or aren't really familiar with it. But usually once you start talking about some of the elements of it, it starts to pop up, because it's been in so many, you know, brief mentions of it in so many true crime books over the years. But in December of 1927, a little girl named Marion Parker, she was a twin, which doesn't really play a huge part in the story, but it should have probably sparked some nervousness at the school where she attended, when a young man came in, it was about 10 days before Christmas, came in, and said he was there to pick up the oldest Parker girl because her father had been in a car accident and she was needed at the hospital. Now, the woman who was at the desk at the school at the time didn't think much of it because this man who came in asking for Marion was so, well, he didn't ask for her by name, only for the oldest Parker girl, had come in and he was so well-spoken, so friendly, so just seemed so clean-cut and normal. He said that he worked at the bank where Perry Parker was one of the management people at the bank, and that he, you know, needed to bring her to the hospital because of the accident. So Marion just happened to be the closest of the two sisters who were to the office. So they got her and turned her over to this guy, and he put her in a car and drove away. It was the last time anybody ever saw her alive again. It was a different time. That was one thing that you think about when right. you hear this story, because you can't believe that an official at a school would just send this girl off with a stranger. But this was 1927. Nobody thought much of it. I will tell you that the woman, just as a side note, the woman who did turn Marion over to what turned out to be her abductor and murderer, later ended up in a mental institution. She couldn't deal with what had happened when all was said and done. She just literally lost her mind. Well, Marion was sent off with this young man who then sent a ransom note to her father. Now, to kind of make a what would be a really it's a really long and fairly complex story, to cut that down to you, he sent these letters, these anonymous letters, and he signed them the Fox. That was how he identified himself, and that he was holding her for ransom and that he wanted her father to turn over $1,500. That was it. Now, Perry Parker, Marion's father, was not a wealthy man, but he did work at a bank and he did do quite well for himself. And the police, when they were finally brought into the case, because at first he didn't contact them because the kidnapper told him not to. And when the police were brought in, they were just completely befuddled as to why this guy would want such a small amount of money for a ransom. That's never really been explained, other than, well, the kidnapper was very disturbed. His name was William Edward Hickman. And in the course of everything that happened from here on out through his trial, through his time in prison, and before he went to the gallows for this murder, he gave a number of different explanations as to why he had kidnapped Marion. For one thing, he had worked at the bank. He really had worked at the bank where Perry Parker had worked, and he had been fired for forging some checks. Perry Parker had been one of the people responsible. So I guess you could look at it and say that it might have been some element of revenge. But for the most part, Hickman swore to the gallows that God had told him to do this, that God had told him that he needed to commit a huge crime, a big time crime. That's what he was supposed to do. And so he chose to kidnap Marion Parker. Now, you know, there are a lot of conflicting stories as to what he told his attorneys, what he told prison guards. Mostly the kid was just really disturbed. He was only 21 years old, very young. And I haven't even gotten to what he did yet, because he sent these ransom notes to Marion's father wanting this money, and Perry Parker did follow through on the ransom. In fact, he, after one aborted attempt when the police followed him, he met him the second night, handed over the money. Hickman was in disguise, had a shotgun, had Marion sitting next to him on the seat of the car, and he said, "I'm going to take this money and I'm going to pull up a little bit further. I'll put her out and then you can take her home." Well, the car pulled up about 50 yards, stopped. The passenger door opened and Marion fell out onto the ground. So Perry Parker, of course, immediately ran up to his daughter and scooped her into his arms and realized that she felt very light. Hickman had murdered Marion and had cut off her arms and legs and had sewn her eyes open so it would look like she was still alive.
Oh, my God.
And it had wrapped her up. So when Perry Parker picked up his daughter, he was picking up a head that was barely attached and a torso, and that was all. Her arms and legs were found, and her internal organs were found wrapped in packages in a public park the following day by some guys who were out hiking along the road. this was the most, seriously, this is probably one of the most horrific crimes I've ever written about, short of, say, Albert Fish. I mean, I've written about Fish, who was a cannibal and a pedophile. This was almost as bad, because Hickman went into great detail to his attorneys about how he murdered Marion and how he cut her apart, how he, you know, put her in the bathtub and drained her of her blood. I mean, it's a horrific story. And he never even expressed any kind of, you know, that he was sorry for what he'd done. He, no regret, no remorse. He simply sat and told his attorneys this story, and they became convinced he was insane. I will say he was disturbed. I don't believe he was insane. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he tried to hide it and tried to cover it up. And when his identity was learned, he went on the run and remained on the run for a couple of weeks before they finally caught up with him up in Oregon. And eventually he was brought in. Yeah,
well, let me ask you this.
It's a horrifying story.
Now, you said that he did work at the bank at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, I'm not trying to ignore the rest of the horrific nature of this, but I'm wondering what the laws were at that time with asking such a small amount of money, knowing and working at a bank. Was he aware of what was considered a misdemeanor, what was considered a felony, what was considered, you know, a major felony? Do you think that maybe the price was, if he got caught, it would be at a lesser extent legally if he took that?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The main reason that we can find that he asked for $1,500 is because that's the amount of money he needed to attend a religious school. And I'm not joking here. He had been in a lot of trouble with the law. He had grown up down south, had moved to the Kansas City area, and had actually had a pretty brilliant high school career. He was not abused. He wasn't hated in school. He wasn't bullied or picked on. He was part of the debate society, and he was like a whiz at it. I mean, the kid was like a borderline genius was how everybody described him. I mean, he was so good at it. He won all these awards, and then he went to the state competition and came in second place. And that seemed to sort of send him into a spiral, which to me, a lot of this looks like maybe like an onset of schizophrenia or something. I mean, everything came on when he was in his late teens. His whole personality changed. He stopped having friends. He stopped competing in the debate contests, and he started dabbling in minor petty crimes. And thought nothing of the fact that he was going to commit a kidnapping. He decided that because, you know, now God was talking to him, according to his stories, and he wanted to attend a religious college back in Kansas City. He'd been living in L.A. He had been involved in a couple of holdups with a partner, which eventually they got him on that, too, because someone was murdered during a drugstore robbery. We still don't know if it was him or his accomplice. They both claimed the other one did it. But he decided he was going to clean himself up, clean up his act, and go back to Kansas City, but was going to kidnap somebody to get the money together for school, which was going to cost $1,500. That's what he said. So he knew Perry Parker from the bank, and he'd been, as I said, one of the people responsible for making sure he was fired when he got into trouble. And so maybe he just figured, you know, he'd seen Marion used to like to go down to the bank with her dad and sort of hang around. And so he knew that he had a daughter, but didn't know that there were twins. He only knew that he only knew of one. So he decided that he'd go to the school and say he wanted her, and he knew Perry Parker would pay up. But why he committed the murder, we don't know. He would have gotten away with it, just kidnapping her. He could have taken the money, disappeared. It was 1927. Nobody would have ever found him. I mean, it wasn't like his picture was going to go out on the internet. I mean, no one would have found him. He could have gone back to Kansas City and did whatever he wanted to do. But obviously there were some screws loose somewhere, because he just decided, after keeping her for a couple of days and claiming that they became friends and he took her to the movies and out to dinner and all kinds of crazy stuff, one day he just snapped and decided to kill her. He just decided that he was going to kill her, and did so in this horrible way. And, you know, his excuse was he cut her up so he could carry her out in a suitcase. But, you know, this he put a lot of work into this, what he did. I mean,
well, now he claims that he'd become friendly with her and had taken her to a movie.
Right.
Were there any eyewitnesses to prove that, yes, she had been seen in his company after going missing?
No.
So this might have been more just of his own delusions.
Exactly. That's a very good possibility because, no, there was nothing to back that side of the story. Well, there was nothing to back up pretty much any of his stories because he got really creative with a lot of his stories about what he did. It wasn't until, I mean, after telling his attorneys what he did so that they could try to get him off on an insanity plea, he then kind of shut up about things until right before he was executed. And I think at that point he knew, you know, his attorneys had extended every stay of execution, and he finally sat down with one of his guards and told him that.
All right, well, hold on. Before you get into too much of that, I want to reel back into the story a little bit. So he's using a fake name. He's come to collect money using a disguise and has done this, then goes on the run. If he's using a fake name, wearing a disguise, how did they figure out who this man was?
Well, eventually it was a little piece at a time, just little bits of things. They finally traced him to the apartment building where he had lived. The police, because when he had taken the body and had wrapped Marion up in these towels, they actually had the name of his apartment building on them. This guy, he was not what you would call a criminal genius here.
Which is strange because he was so hyper intelligent, right?
Right. Well, he had been until he just sort of went off the deep end one day. He had always been the super smart kid, but, you know, so were Leopold and Loeb, if you know, remember the Bobby Franks murder.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was, you know, they used a typewriter from Loeb's, you know, fraternity house, and he dropped his eyeglasses at the scene. They were not exactly super criminals either, and neither was William Hickman. You know, he used towels from his apartment building to wrap the body, and the police came there actually looking and didn't find anything and ended up coming back and realized that that's how they eventually found him. They traced the apartment and found blood in the apartment and realized that it was him. So they started looking for him, put up the wanted posters. Broadcasts went out, and that's kind of the other funny thing. They're not funny, especially not to the guys who were stopped, beaten up, arrested, and nearly killed. They put out a what he looked like. Well, he was very, I don't know, kind of ordinary for the 20s.
Right.
Young, very young guy, dark hair, dark wavy hair. They put out a description, and soon every young guy with dark wavy hair was being pulled over by the police because when the details of this story went out in California, people went nuts. I mean, this was probably at that point, I would say one of the most horrific crimes in California history at that time.
Oh, and I guess. And as you said, kind of a nondescript look to him. I have to laugh about that. We do these dumb crimes, stupid criminals on every show, and you don't know how many people send me pictures of suspected criminals and drawings of a bald guy with a goatee who could be me. And it's hey, Dave, where were you when this crime took place? And I'm like, And people will tell me that in Minnesota. They're like, boy, you look familiar. And then I look around and I say, or do I look like every one of the other bald fat guys with a goatee in the state of Minnesota? And, you know, oh, yeah, I guess there is that. But you think about that aspect of it. And even, you know, I think that's what made, and I know you're well familiar with this story, the prolific serial killer H.H. Holmes so dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because his look was so similar. And if you look at pictures, aside from the famous one of Francis Tumblety with the big crazy handlebar mustache, most of the photographs of Tumblety look very similar to H.H. Holmes. So there are some, you know, those were the looks of the time. And when you get into that run, it's got to be extremely hard for law enforcement. And we're talking pre, you know, Ballad Who music, CSI stuff going on. They were just going on the most basic of information that they were able to get. And that had to just be a very hard time to put this together. But considering that they were able to find, you know, some of the clues, like wrapping it up in the towels that were named from the location and everything. So, you know, some of the clues were luckily dropped right into their lap. But that's still quite an undertaking to have to go after.
Yeah. And, you know, and it easy to disappear back then too.
Sure.
Luckily we, you know, by the '20s we were starting to use, you know, fingerprint technology and that kind of thing. And what happened was they found the car that he had used when he tried to make the ransom or when he collected the ransom. And, and he was also spending the marked bills that didn't hurt either, but they found the car abandoned not too far away from his apartment building. And when they traced the fingerprints inside, they found, you know, because he had committed past crimes, they found that he was on file. So that helped also. So, I mean, things were really pretty easy. I mean, he didn't wear gloves. I just don't think he ever thought, I don't think it ever crossed his mind that he'd be caught. You know, he was a young kid. I mean, really, he was a kid himself. You know, he was barely, you know, a dozen years older than the girl he kidnapped and murdered. So he's a very young guy, and he just assumed he'd never be caught. Went on the run, and, you know, people were being pulled over and arrested and brought in for questioning, everybody that looked like him. And eventually, though, they found him. He just did a lot of dumb things. And eventually a couple of local cops in Oregon pulled him over and realized who he was. And because they had gotten, you know, flyers. And by that time, his photograph was out everywhere. Within, you know, as long as he stayed on the run, his photograph was finally started to spread around. And a couple of kind of local yokel cops, you know, pulled him over and realized who he was and arrested him. And, you know, the district attorney of Los Angeles personally went up to Oregon to escort him back by train. And I think once he realized he was caught, he became, you know, like so many other criminals, like Charlie Manson and some of these other guys, just decided to revel in the limelight as this monster, you know, started kissing up to the press and, you know, and reporters were back then especially were eager to ask questions, and he answered everything, much to, I'm sure, his attorney's dismay. And, you know, once they had him, they brought him back to LA and put him on trial and, you know, had a couple of attorneys who decided to try to get him off on an insanity plea, which didn't work. The jury just wasn't buying it.
I wonder if, you know, you say that much to the chagrin of the attorneys, he was opening his mouth. I wonder if that's almost more suited for somebody that you want to prove is insane, because if he's telling so many different stories and so many contradictory stories, and yet and he seems to be gleefully reveling in this, I would think that would play into it even better, that this is obviously insane. And it's surprising to me that back in the 20s, that wouldn't have been more of, you know, now that we have a deeper understanding of mental illness, it's easy to quickly dismiss that. But you would think in the 20s, they might have been a little bit more willing to accept the fact that it was, you know, a criminally insane person doing this type of crime, especially because of the heinous nature.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I don't think that people were. I think we were at a period then that it was still too new of a thing. I mean, this was the first case in California history that was tried on an insanity defense. There had never been one in California before. So I think that probably hurt their chances. On the other hand, it was so fresh on the heels of Leopold and Loeb. I mean, it was only a couple of years later. And that, I think, didn't help matters any, because, you know, those guys tried an insanity defense. They lost it. Clarence Darrow tried to make it so that they at least wouldn't be executed. I mean, because he, you know, it was too late to try to save them from prison, but he at least tried to save them from the gallows. And he did. He got them 99 or life plus 99 years for kidnapping, which is a pretty long prison sentence. But I think that because of the time period, and again, another thing to remember about Los Angeles in the 1920s is things were still pretty fresh there. I mean, you know, California had been, you know, settled years before, but, you know, LA was a new city still in the 1920s. I mean, it really didn't come around and start turning into a city until the teens. So it was still pretty fresh. And I think that no one with all the publicity that this murder got, I don't think there was anybody who was willing to say that they thought he was crazy. I mean, besides that, legally speaking, the fact that he did try to cover up his crime and did go on the run shows that he knew that what he'd done was wrong. And that's pretty much what the district attorney used to make sure he got prosecuted.
Oh, sure.
Was that his stories didn't make any sense. Plus, you know, he did try to cover up the crime. So he knew what he was doing when he did it, and that's pretty much what sold the jury, at least gave them the excuse.
When he was finally apprehended, how forthcoming was he? Did they say, you know, we know who you are, we know what you did? Did he cop to a story immediately, or you know, start lying about it right out of the chute?
No. He didn't lie. He immediately admitted once he got caught. He was like, well, I guess you got me. You know, so then he decided that he was going to get as much mileage out of the attention as he could. And in fact, on the way back to Los Angeles, sat down with a couple of detectives who'd been involved in the case from the beginning, and Asa Keys, the DA from Los Angeles, and actually sat and confessed the whole thing and told them the whole story on the way back on the train.
But yet he still gave no real understanding of why the murder.
No, he didn't. He really didn't. Not at first. And that story kept changing. So, I don't think we'll ever really know why he did it, other than he was, you know, I think we just have to leave it at and say and accept the fact that he was disturbed. I mean, that he was a sick individual.
What were some of the reasons?
That's about all we can do.
Yeah, could you give us a little bit of information on a few of the different aspects?
Sure. I mean, he claimed that he was sure that he was going to get caught because she had been so easygoing. Marion had been so easygoing for the first couple of days, even though she, you know, had wanted to go home and missed her parents. And, you know, she had written a couple of the notes. That's where the title of the book comes from, is, you know, Daddy, please do what he tells you to do. You know, I want to come home tonight. That's where that title actually comes from, one of the notes that she wrote to her parents, and it was included with the ransom letters that he sent to Perry Parker, really kind of taunting Perry Parker more than anything, that, you know, I have your daughter's life in my hands and I can kill her at any time, but I don't want to. Well, by the time, you know, he got these letters, Marion was already dead, but he had no way of knowing that. But, you know, he said, you know, Marion was so easygoing at first, but then she just kept crying. You know, I had decided to take her home. And again, we're never going to know how much of or any of this is true, but he claimed he finally had decided to give up on the whole thing and was going to take her home, or at least just drop her off in front of the house and drive away, because that's what Marion kept asking him to do. And because she wouldn't stop crying, he decided that he had to kill her or he was going to get caught. That was one of the reasons that he gave as to why he committed the murder. He didn't explain why he decided to dismember her, but that's why he claimed that he decided to kill her. And then, of course, there was the, you know, God told me to commit this great crime. I can't help it. You know, he told me he wouldn't talk to me anymore if I didn't. I mean, that was one of them. And then, of course, he told his prison guard shortly before his execution that he did it because he wanted to, just because he wanted to. And he enjoyed every minute of it and loved cutting her up and, you know, taking her apart and sewing her eyes open and that kind of thing. So who knows?
Well, with if it may be an amalgam of all three, right? That maybe initial intent was to steal the money, and as things got more hyped and he felt that her crying was going to get him caught, he did the murder and then found that he really enjoyed that. So it might be kind of an amalgam, but I'm curious, you know, especially with the detective nature of your personality, when he was on the run, were you able to, or did you even take a look at the places that he stopped? Were there any other strange murders that took place in his pathway prior to being apprehended?
Not that I've ever been able to find. As far as I know, this was the only murder that he committed, you know, in this manner. As I said, there was about a year before, there was a drugstore robbery. And the owner of the drugstore was shot to death. And we don't know if Ed Hickman pulled the trigger or if it was his accomplice. They both pinned it on the other one. So we don't know if this is, but my guess is that he probably committed that murder, but it was a completely different kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that, like you said, I think that the reason for killing this dismembering Marion probably came from a combination of a couple of things. I'm not sure that I ever believe that he really thinks God told him to. I think that was something that he cooked up for his attorneys when he was working on his insanity plea. But, I mean, we'll never know. But I think that part of it was that he did it because he could. I think he wanted to, and he did it because he had this little girl's life in his hands. He had her under his complete power, and he was this, you know, really had become this very odd young man who, you know, really was overwhelmed by pretty much life in general and had turned to petty crimes to try and survive. And I think part of that was, a power trip too. I think he always tried to dominate. He dominated his partner that he had worked with. You know, it was younger than he was when he committed these crimes. And I think that this was a chance for this guy who, you know, who really wanted to dominate someone, which is why he kidnapped such a young girl. And I think he wanted to kill her. Now, why in the world he would have cut her up the way he did,
right,
I couldn't even begin to guess. My mind doesn't quite work that way.
Well, you know, I think,
and
again, that
really sure.
That was probably, you know, something. Again, I think that may have been a version of the truth. I mean, once you've done this crime, how do you get a dead body out of the building? It's got to be pretty hard, especially if it's an apartment building and you've got to walk past people. However,
right,
if you're able to contain smaller pieces in luggage and get them out of the building, that would make sense for why it happened. And I know, you know, having covered true crime as many years as we have on the show, that seems to be the MO for a lot of these people, is it's the quickest and easiest way to smuggle the body parts out or drop them off in different locations to make identification even harder. Weird stuff. Now, with this said, okay, you've got this guy. Obviously, Kook did all of this. You mentioned the fact that he had been involved in a murder at a drugstore robbery. Did they catch him at that time, or was it not until this arrest that he copped to the drugstore robbery as well?
Right. It wasn't until that point. Yeah, it wasn't until after they had already gotten him for Marion that they were able to trace him back to this drugstore robbery. And they brought in his accomplice, and who confirmed that Hickman had been part of this robbery. And as I said, they both blamed the other for actually someone getting shot, but he confessed to all the stuff, you know, from to stolen cars, to, you know, the forged checks at the bank, to the drugstore robbery. Once he started talking to his attorneys, and see, some of that didn't come out prior to the trial. And I mean, the drugstore robbery did, some of the other stuff didn't. One of his attorneys ended up writing a book about this case quite a few years later before he passed away. And at that point it was okay to kind of spill the beans on some of the things that were told in confidence, at the time. And so more information came out, but they did end up putting him on trial after he had been convicted for Marion's murder. They put him on trial for the drugstore robbery. And, he ended up testifying against his accomplice, and his accomplice testified against him. And Hickman was already on his way to the gallows, so it really didn't matter. But the other kid who'd been involved did end up with some prison time for the drugstore robbery. They just could never prove who actually fired the fatal bullet.
What was that final judgment against those two?
Well, Hickman ended up with a longer sentence against him, which, like I said, didn't really matter as it turned out. The other kid ended up spending, I believe, about a decade behind bars, eventually got out, died of old age. I mean, he actually lived and never really talked about anything of what happened in his later life. I think his grandkids or something found out who he was, you know, his connection to that case.
Gotcha.
But he never really talked about it.
How,
you know,
big?
So, and I don't think he was involved with the Marion Parker thing at all.
Right.
By that time, Hickman was on his own. So.
How big of a circus did this become in California at the time, since this was such a tragic and gruesome murder?
Huge, huge. I mean, it was the front page of every paper in the state. Well, it was across the country. I mean, there were murder ballads written about this case. There were songs written, and, you know, there were newspapers covered it from coast to coast because it was such a, you know, I mean, it was the 20s. It was right after Leopold and Loeb, and people wanted a good, juicy story. And, man, this was one. And he, you know, was on the run for a couple of weeks, and the newspapers were screaming about that. And when they finally got him, they covered every single bit of stuff that they could in the papers. You know, every time somebody came to testify, you know, they had family members who came in. His parents were divorced. But his father had originally had washed his hands of him. He didn't want anything to do with him. He disowned him. And then and eventually came to trial and said, well, you know, I don't know, you know, what to think about this, but his mother's nuts. I mean, that's pretty much what he came down to. And it did turn out that Hickman's mother had spent some time in an insane asylum. He did have some insanity that ran through his family. Now, I'm not convinced that, and again, this is just me talking, this is my opinion, I'm not convinced that any of this was hereditary with Hickman. I think he used it as an excuse. His mother did have a lot of mental issues, but I really don't, but he had very little to do with her at the trial. When she would come to testify, he wouldn't even acknowledge her. He wouldn't speak to her, wouldn't look at her. It wasn't until he was in prison and awaiting his execution that they spent any time together at all. And we don't know what was said during that meeting. No one's ever talked about it. No one ever released that information. So that sort of remains a mystery. But I've always thought that he kind of took the insanity that ran in the family, a couple of family members. There was, you know, a couple of different things that family came in and talked about, and especially with his mother. But I think he used it as an excuse trying to work on that insanity plea and save himself from being hanged. But in the end, it didn't really work out for him.
Well, let's talk about that. How long after the conviction did he serve before his death sentence was carried out?
It was, I believe, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, I think it lasted about a year. He had several different times when he was supposed to be executed, and his attorneys would get a stay and or a new trial, you know, and it struck out. Not nearly as long as it does today, you know, where people can go to death row and stay there for 12, 15 years.
How are they getting stays at that time, Troy? I mean, for gosh sakes, he admitted to it. He copped to it. They're able to pin the murder to where it happened and his involvement. On what grounds would the governor give him a stay of execution?
Well, they would come up with new information or would find a sympathetic judge who would delay the execution until they could have another doctor come in and examine him, that kind of thing. They were still working. His attorneys worked the insanity angle all the way to the end. I mean, they just kept trying to bring it back up, and they did keep postponing the execution until finally they just ran out of tries, and he eventually was hanged. And he went to the gallows and not very well. I mean, you know, you read about a lot of these guys that stand up and make their, you know, funny statements and dying declarations. They actually had to carry him up the stairs because he broke down weeping at the bottom of the steps, and a couple of guards had to pick him up under the arms and carry him up to the gallows. He didn't go gracefully to the end. So
when he did that, did he ever show remorse for the actual crime, or was it just remorse that I got caught, please don't kill me?
Yeah, no, he never showed remorse for the crime. He bragged about it. He laughed about it. He, you know, claimed he was crazy until it didn't work anymore. And then literally on the eve of his execution, one of his guards just asked him, well, why did you do it? And he then sat down and told him, I did it because I wanted to, and I loved every minute of it. And that guard never forgot it. I mean, the things he said to him that night, he never forgot. And he went to the gallows the next day. So, I mean, he never expressed any remorse to anybody about what he did. Not to Perry Parker, not to the brother, the sister, the mother. I mean, none of them. You know, he never expressed remorse.
Did he ever have a negative run-in with Parker? Is that part of why he was singled out? Or was it just an opportunist moment? He knew he had a daughter, so that was enough.
Yeah, you know, that's funny, because when they told Perry Parker who it was they were looking for, he didn't believe it. He's like, no, that's you know, yes, we had a falling out. I don't think they really ever had much contact with each other. I mean, Perry Parker was one of the people who, when the allegations came in that, you know, the Hickman had been forging checks, you know, rather than make it a big deal, he just said, no, he needs to be fired. And they didn't even really press charges. He was put on probation for the check writing. So Parker never really, I don't think he even really knew him other than probably by sight. They had to tell him when they're saying, this is who we're looking for, and he used to work at your bank. And he's like, what? I mean, he couldn't believe it. I mean, he finally had to remember who it was and remember, you know, that they'd had, you know, a bad contact there just with the check thing. But he wasn't his sworn enemy. It wasn't, I mean, if it was revenge, it was all on Hickman's side. Perry Parker had very little knowledge of even who he was. He didn't even believe it at first. And throughout the trial and everything, usually Parker didn't even attend. Usually it was his oldest son who would come to the courtroom and would stay in there. He's usually the one who, you know, made any statements to the press. Parker made a couple. And when it was all over, he was just like, well, you know, this is it. We have to just figure out a way to go on. You know, I mean, our life has been shattered by this, and we're just going to have to figure out a way to go on with our life. And that's pretty much, that was the end of it. He never, you know, came out and said anything like, oh, you know, I can't wait till they hang him. Nothing like that. He never made any statements like that at all. He was a very, you know, well-liked, respected, pretty calm, laid back kind of guy. And I think this, I mean, I really think that obviously the murder of his daughter this way ruined his life. In fact, the whole family's life. He spent most of his time trying to make sure that his, the Marion's sister and his wife never really knew all the details of what happened. They never read about it in the newspaper. And it was different back then. You know, you got your news from the radio or the newspaper. There was nothing else. And he did everything he could to make sure they never even learned of the details of how Marion died. I'm sure that it must have happened later, especially with her sister. But during the time it was all going on, he kept them very sheltered from everything that was happening, just because he knew they were already, you know, already upset, distraught, heartbroken, and he didn't want to make it any worse. So, you know, it's the whole thing was just a heartbreaking, horrific case.
Yeah, it seems like every aspect of it was just nasty. So this crime, this guy is finally caught. He's put to death for this crime. Talk to me a little bit about the aftermath. I mean, as we were talking about paranormal activity in some of these cases, was his spirit ever sensed or seen again? Or what about hers?
No, the only ghost story associated with the crime is the one that I had kind of heard about from the people who moved into the house and didn't even realize they had moved into the home of a little girl who had been murdered. You know, at that point, about 50 years before, they didn't have any idea. It wasn't until later that they discovered that, you know, this was Perry Parker's old house, and that would explain some of the things that were happening, you know, with the lights that turned off and the sound, the footsteps, the laughing, the voices of what appeared to be a little girl. And they had seen this little dark-headed girl in the house, and she was there one moment and gone the next. There wasn't anything, you know, surprisingly, you know, with a crime so brutal and so heinous, you would think that this would be sort of a tortured kind of haunting, but it really isn't. I think that we're at the other end of the spectrum. I think that Marion, who desperately just wanted to go home, that's all she wanted. She wanted it all to be over so that she could go home. And I think that in death, she finally got what she wanted. And I think that she's at the place that she wanted to be and is happy there and doesn't, for whatever reason, hasn't left. You know, whether or not it was because her life was cut so short or because she wanted to stay and wanted to stay at a place she loved, because that was just her favorite thing. She was a little girl who had a lot of friends and loved to go out and play. But more than anything, she just liked to be at home with her parents and her sister. That's what she liked to do. And that's where she spent every evening. That's what she did on her weekends. She liked to be at home. She spent time, you know, cooking in the kitchen with her mom. She went to work sometimes with her dad, and she just loved being at home. And that was, you know, something that she desperately wanted when she was being held captive by, you know, Ed Hickman. And
is the apartment
her wish?
Is the apartment where Hickman dismembered her and murdered her still in existence, or was that eventually torn down?
The building is still there. I have never heard of any hauntings that have taken place at the place. I mean, I've never heard anything about it or picked anything like that up, but it is still in existence. The building's still there.
You know, we understand to a degree why a haunting would occur, especially in a tragic situation. If it was something fast, if it was something brutal, that the spirit may be seeking justice, the spirit may be seeking help. But it just seems after all these years that these spirits continue to play out in some of these locations where murder took place. That's where it gets disheartening and kind of freaky for me, to be honest with you, Troy, because you would hope that a spirit would find rest, even in a brutal case like that, that at some point they, and especially an innocent like her, Marion, would find peace and rest at some point. But to think that their soul or spirit may still be just wandering or lost is the really weird aspect. What do you think? I mean, all the years of research you've done into the paranormal, why do you think these things still stay anchored to these locations so much?
Well, I think that I would not have been surprised to hear that the apartment building where, you know, the apartment where Ed Hickman killed her was haunted by a tortured spirit, you know, by who's trapped there, you know, as is often the case with these violent events. You know, we mentioned the Liska early on. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by any of the spirits who have remained there at a place where their lives were cut short. But I think in this particular case, for whatever reason, that the haunting that's come out of this case is that Marion haunts the house where she used to live, not where she died, not where she knew these terrible, terrifying last moments, but, you know, at a place that she had peace. And I think that, you know, we don't really know what happens after we die. We don't know what the afterlife really is. I mean, none of us know for sure. I mean, someday we'll all find out, but right now we don't know. But for, you know, when you mentioned that, you know, it's too bad or it's heartbreaking that spirits can't find peace after a crime like this, but I think she has. I mean, I think that is her peace. I don't think she is lost. I think we don't know what's going on in her world, in her timeline, in her afterlife. For all we know, her afterlife is reliving those happy moments that she spent the first 12 years of her life in that house. Maybe she's reliving those over and over again, and the people who have seen her, who have encountered her or experienced her in the house are getting a glimpse into her afterlife. You know, it's not that she's there trying to, you know, trying to get someone to do anything for her, to finish some business for her. Her business has been finished. I mean, you know, we know what happened to her killer. He paid the price. You know, it's not an unsolved crime. We know what happened. I mean, it's a terrible crime, but it's been resolved. And, you know, I like to think that this is her afterlife, that she's happy there, she's peaceful there, and that's why she stayed. I mean, I think if she was lost or restless, it would be at that apartment building. But because it's not, I think that really she's happy.
The idea that, you know, murders like this occur all the time, blood is spilled, and these killers, you know, in some cases find their comeuppance, and in other cases, sometimes tragically, nobody ever really knows what happened to them. You know, Jeff Belanger has been on record as saying he believes ghosts are history's way of reminding us of where we've been so that we never forget these, you know, these aspects of history. And especially when you're talking about murder, I often wonder if these really are the spirits in the sense that we believe them to be, you know, we die in our discorporeal, you know, soul leaves the body and stays there, or is this nothing more than an echo or reflection so that this ground always plays that message for people? And sometimes it can be an intelligent haunting, because the I would guess, you know, when people always think it's residual or intelligent, if it's energy and it's left behind, maybe she has gone on or he has gone on, but this etched piece of glass that's left behind has characteristics so that it can be interacted with in brief ways, which is why we may get the get outs or the lights flickering or things. It's more of an energetic pulse than it is an intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, I've always believed that the majority of hauntings are energy, are just history imprinted on a place, you know, that we see for whatever reason. I find that with crimes or violent events, whether it be crimes or you know, that kind of thing, those seem to be a higher percentage of intelligent spirits because of the fact that they were cut off the way that they were and left there, you know, in a moment of violence. And some don't realize they're dead. Some are trying to get someone to solve their murder, you know, unfinished business, whatever, you know. I find that with those, it seems to be, they seem to be more interactive with crime scenes than you do most other, you know, than just the ghost that wanders up and down the stairs at, you know, Aunt Tilly's house, you know, you know,
exactly.
Those seem to be more residual, you know, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it could be more intelligent than anything. I mean, that totally makes a lot of sense. I just think that in this case, and maybe it is, maybe Marion's, what people are experiencing is some glimmer of what happened there originally. And it's not something bad. It just happens to be something that her spirit, her energy left behind there. But I kind of like to think that she's at peace. I hope she is, because, I mean, she certainly deserves it. So I'd like to think that she is, but
We throw back to our beginning talk about the Villisca Axe Murder House, and that people have had experiences there and collected some horrible auditory evidence. And I don't mean horrible as in bad evidence, but as in graphic, violent natured evidence. What can you tell me, what was your experience at Villisca?
Well, I think that I think Villisca is a combination of different things. I mean, just because, you know, we have different, you know, categories of hauntings doesn't mean that one place can't have several categories. It could be anything from, you know, from just energy, like a poltergeist type energy, or it could be residual, or it could be intelligent. I think that Villisca may be a combination of everything. My experiences there have been both interactive and what I thought were probably residual. I mean, I've been followed up the stairs by footsteps, witnessed by me and by other people. I have seen the spirits there actually interact with people, like do things on command. One night we were there and we were asking, you know, on camera to open the door of the closet, and it would open and close on command with cameras trained at it at the time. We left the house for an hour, left the cameras on, left the house for an hour, watched it on cameras or watched it on a monitor, and the door never moved on its own, not once. But when we came back in and asked it to do it again, it started opening and closing. I've seen things roll across the floor, stop, complete stop, reverse direction, and roll back the other way. I mean, I think that it's an interactive haunting, but I also think that a lot of the things that are picked up there, from, you know, people's equipment to even EVP recordings, are imprinted on that place. I mean, I think it's imprinted on the atmosphere. I mean, that is a very small location with some very brutal history. And I think that we'd be, you know, naive, or at least just ignoring, you know, the facts, to say that nothing could have imprinted itself there, you know, to say that the atmosphere there isn't charged up with the events that happened that night in 1912. It can be a very quiet place, or it can be a really active, terrifying place. But definitely, I mean, it's definitely one of those places that I will say, I won't say, oh, you know, I've heard it's haunted, or people say it's haunted. I'll just say it's haunted, you know, firsthand, it's haunted.
And if people are interested, Troy, in some of your other true crime books like this, what are some of the other titles so they know to look it up?
Well, I've done a book called One August Morning about the Lizzie Borden murders. I've done one called Murder by Gaslight about H.H. Holmes. Murder in Their Beds is the Villisca book. The Two Lost Girls, which is a story about the Grime sisters in Chicago. Bloody Illinois. Dead Men Do Tell Tales, Bloody Hollywood. I do a lot on this particular category. So I really delve into the true crime stuff when it's connected to the paranormal. So it's really what I really dig that. So
We'll keep in touch. Certainly, we'd love to have you back on and talk some more. Sure. And like I said, I'd love to chat about the Villisca Axe Murder House and talk about the serial killings that you uncovered that show that this was maybe just one stop along the murder railroad, which is new news to me, and I'm sure as many of our listeners. We've covered Villisca in the past, but not this aspect. So please come back and join us. Like I said, maybe we can chat about this in October. Fascinating stuff. Do you have anything coming up soon we can let listeners know about? Any new conferences, tours, anything going on?
Well, now it's Halloween season coming up, so we got lots of tours and events, and we've got our big Dead of Winter event we're just planning now for February 2018, and then of course the national conference coming back up next June. So we've already lined up all our speakers for that, and we're starting to slowly unspool our information for it. So yeah, we're always busy. So,
and what's the best website for people to check out to keep up with your tours and events?
AmericanHauntingsInc.com, and that's Inc with a K, like ink pen, so, or tattoo ink. So
fantastic.
But AmericanHauntingsInc.com. So,
all right, we appreciate it, Troy Taylor. Always a pleasure speaking with you. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week, kids. Steph Young returns, and we're going to talk about the smiley face killer. She has a different perspective and a unique take on this story. You're going to want to hear. We've got now time to turn over to one of your favorite parts of the show. Tim, let's take a look at this week's Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Well, Tim, and it's kind of like the old adage from Forrest Gump, stupid is as stupid does. It's a shame that this story should even come up, but as we're talking about dumb crimes and stupid criminals, with the passing of Hurricane Irma and the damage that she's done, there were a lot of warnings. Get out of town, have enough food on hand, be secure, be safe, right?
Right.
Here's one that you just never really would have thought of, and thank God the police did. Hurricane Irma, Florida police urge residents not to fire their guns at the vicious storm.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think that would be a given. Like, well, yeah. I'm going to take that sumbitch out myself, Tim. I'm going to shoot that with some buckshot, knock it straight out the sky. Whatever you do, don't fire guns at Hurricane Irma as it rips through Florida. That's what one sheriff's office in Florida is warning residents over Twitter. To clarify, do not shoot weapons at hashtag Irma, the Pasco sheriff's office tweeted late Saturday. You won't make it turn around, and it will have very dangerous side effects. I'm going to turn this sumbitch around. Florida, you people are just ridiculous. It might seem like a strange warning, but there's a reason behind it. Around 80,000 people have expressed interest in a Facebook group titled Shoot at Hurricane Irma as of 8 a.m. this past Sunday. And no, I'm not trying to pick on Floridians, Tim. I know that what they just dealt with is tragic and destructive, and our prayers and thoughts continue, but this story needed to be reported. This is how the Facebook page starts up. Yo, so this goofy-looking windy head named Irma said they pulling up on us. The Facebook event's description reads, let's show Irma that we shoot first. The event scheduled for 10 a.m. Sunday with the vague location of just Florida immediately prompted dire warnings from the Pasco Sheriff's Office and others on Twitter suggesting the plan was pointless at best and dangerous at worst. So, don't do that, Tim. Don't shoot at tornadoes. Don't shoot at hurricanes. Don't shoot at children. Don't shoot at neighbors or co-workers or anybody for that matter. Irma is a Category 4 storm. It's already barreled through the Dominican Republic, parts of Haiti, Puerto Rico, the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, and others, leaving devastation in its wake. Ryan Edwards, who created the viral Facebook event, said it came from a combination of stress and boredom. The response is a complete and total surprise to me, he told BBC. I never envisioned this event becoming some kind of crazy idea larger than myself. It has become something a little out of my control. Yeah, so just I think if anything we've learned, let's not encourage people to shoot at stupid stuff, Tim.
Well, you know, there is a picture out there on social media, Dave, of the actual face of Hurricane Irma.
Yeah, I've seen that. And it was live streaming, but from what I also heard was that was actually footage caught from another storm, and somebody was just playing it on their video and then live streaming that, so it looked like it was the actual storm.
Well, that doesn't matter. They just need a target to shoot at, Dave. And they were given that target. So
I'll get that sumbitch. I'll shoot it straight out the sky, damn. Well, speaking of guns, Tim, let's leave Florida alone for a few minutes. Gun found in a strip search of woman at McLean County Jail. We're going to Bloomington, Missouri for this. A Missouri woman faces armed violence charges after a handgun was found inside her.
What?
Vaginal cavity.
No.
Yeah. By a McLean County correctional officer performing a strip search related to the woman's arrest on drug charges. This is either a very small gun or a very big holster, Tim. I'm not quite sure which way it goes. Amika Witt, 20, of Ozark, is stopped at 5 a.m. Thursday by Chenoa police after allegedly driving 90 miles per hour on Interstate 55. During a search of the vehicle and the suspect, police found drugs, there's a given, including heroin in the suspect's bra and ecstasy, according to a statement read in court Friday by McLean County Assistant State's Attorney Lane Roberts. Witt is charged with armed violence by possessing a weapon during the alleged commission of a felony and while in possession of drugs and possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver. A passenger in the car, Clinton McDonald, 29, of Springfield, Missouri, was charged with unlawful possession of heroin with intent to deliver the drug and unlawful possession of ecstasy. After Witt was taken in the McLean County Jail, a female correction officer found... I don't know much about guns, Tim. I know you're more of a gun guy than I am.
Uh-huh.
They found the Kimber 380 caliber handgun. Is that a big gun?
No, it's a little 38.
A little 38 caliber.
Yeah.
Okay. If I'm looking at my hand and I make it into the shape of a gun, Tim, how big is the 38 caliber compared to my hand?
Comparable? With the one that they're talking about, just about a little bit smaller than your hand.
That's just a time.
Mm.
Yeah, the gun had a fully loaded magazine and a bullet in the chamber ready to fire, said the prosecutor. This is one woman you do not want to bring to orgasm, Tim.
This isn't the 38 revolver we're all thinking of.
Like God.
You know, because the 38 revolver you're thinking of is probably twice the size of your hand with a big old revolver on it.
Yeah. Well, I got some big hands, Tim. Don't get confused.
This is much smaller, Dave. She's not exactly
She's got a loaded gun with one in the chamber, if you know what I mean. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage said a complete body search is performed on all suspects brought into the facility on drug charges. It's not uncommon for people accused of dealing drugs to be armed, he added. When you find drugs, you look for guns, said Sandage. The weapons incident... While unusual, is not the first that the gun has been brought into the jail, said the sheriff. According to Robert's statement, the woman told police she and McDonald were en route to St. Louis with the drugs. Witt was jailed in lieu of posting $40,000 and $35,000, Tim. $40,000, $35. They had the $40,000. It was the $35,000 that totally screwed him up. McDonald was jailed in lieu of posting $20,000, $35,000. I have to know what the $35,000 is. I need to know. Why not just $40,000 or $20,000? What's the $35? Is that the processing fee?
$35 gets you through the tolls, or you got to have the $35 for back. I mean, you never know when you got to go through the Mickey D's drive-thru.
God. Well, after we just heard that story, this headline just makes me cringe, Tim. Lady pulls a gun from where? I don't know. At Walmart after her kid didn't get... What, Tim? What was the one item that this child needed so badly that mom was willing to pull a gun?
Well, Dave, if I had to take a guess at Walmart, it had to be something in the video game aisle or electronics aisle. So I'm going to go iPhone.
iPhone. That would be a great choice, Tim. That would be a choice that I think any rational, and I highlight rational, did I say rational human being, Tim, would think of? Mm-hmm. Not that that's okay. And don't get me wrong. We're not endorsing pulling a gun to get the last iPhone from people. Don't do it. But, Tim, this one is so much more rich, so much more beautiful. Lady pulls gun at Walmart after her kid didn't get the last 29-cent notebook.
What?
According to USA Today, coming out of Detroit, a gun was pulled after two pairs of women fought over the last notebook on a shelf at a Walmart in Michigan this week, according to police. Novi Police Detective Scott Batens told the Detroit Free Press that police have reviewed video footage of the Monday incident recorded on witnesses' cell phones and have submitted the case to the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office for review. The fight at the Novi Town Center store involved two Farmington Hills residents, age 46 and 32, and a mother and daughter from South Lyon, aged 51 and 20. This is tragic, and I shouldn't be laughing, Tim, but the idea of that this is what caused her to pull the gun. And it's so sad because there's just like, there's a couple of people just standing there with their hands in their pockets just watching this unfold. They're so used to this that it's just like, eh. The perpetrator who pulled the gun, it looks like a soccer mom, a white soccer mom, Tim, and appears to be pulling a gun on another white woman. Not that I'm saying that's anything specific, but that just seems like a weird situation to me all the way around. Mama got a gun and she's willing to wield it for 29-cent notebooks. Police told the Free Press that the 20-year-old also reached for the notebook. The two women pulled the 20-year-old's hair and the woman's mother was pushed aside before pulling out a gun. She pulled out her firearm and tells them to stop attacking her daughter. All right, I'll give you that, while pointing the gun at them, and was quoted as was saying in a Fox 2 Detroit report. So it came down to basically they were feeling a little bullied and a little upset. And she just, how about you just give up the damn notebook, Tim? I'm not a pacifist by nature. I just, you know, I'm a lover, not a fighter, Tim.
Right.
And whipping a gun out for any reason in public seems like a bad idea unless somebody's life is being threatened. And if your life is being threatened over a 29-cent notebook, just give it to them. Here's a little hint. If you find Goodwill in your town, and everybody's got Goodwills, Tim, I know this because I'm a frequent shopper. Goodwill has got the goods, son. They've got notebooks and paper, and they've got pencils, Tim, colored pencils. They've got pens. They got them their compasses and some calculators, Tim. And you can get them for very inexpensively, and you don't have to pull a gun. I've been in a bajillion Goodwills, Tim, because I love them. I love the deals. I love wearing other people's old clothes.
Wow, that's freaky.
Don't judge me. I never felt the need or urge to whip out a pistol, Tim, because somebody got the last, Randy Moss jersey here or something. I don't get it. I don't get it. All right, listen. This story, Tim, just tickles me, and I think it's going to tickle you, too, when we get to the name of the killer for hire.
Okay.
But a man has been sentenced, and this isn't the funny part, Tim. Man sentenced 10 to 20 years in a hit-for-hire case. That means that somebody sought another person to murder another person, Tim. That's how that works. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I am familiar, yeah.
Yeah. And here's the deal. You hire somebody, and if you don't know who you're hiring, first of all, you shouldn't be hiring somebody to kill somebody because that's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad. In the whole cosmic scheme of good, bad, Tim, put that in the bad column.
Okay.
If I were Santa, you would be in the naughty position for that, Tim.
The what?
The naughty position.
The naughty position,
yeah.
You say.
You know, on my list, there's the positions for good and the bad, okay. Tim.
I think you've been in the naughty position a few times.
An inmate serving time at a state prison in White Township was ordered Friday to serve an additional 10 to 20 years in prison for trying to hire the fictional hit woman, Joni Pepperoni.
Joni Pepperoni?
Okay, first of all, you're cruising looking for a deal. I understand it. I'm a Goodwill guy. Yeah. I just explained that. But you're going to go find a hit woman named Joni Pepperoni. That might be the first red flag. I don't know. I know they come with crazy nicknames. I've watched The Sopranos. But Joni Pepperoni seems to be telegraphing that this may not be a legit deal.
Maybe she's good with the sausage. You never know, Dave. She's got skills. She's got a certain set of skills.
Gregory Rauser, the genius, 49, was sentenced for his on-again, off-again guilty plea to criminal solicitation to homicide. Judge Thomas Bianco also ordered Rauser, not Bowser from Sha-na-na.
Sha-na-na.
He is a clean man, Tim. He's not trying to get Joni Pepperoni to do anything illicit. I promise you this. Judge Thomas Bianco also ordered Rauser to pay an unspecified fine and more than $1,500 for the cost of prosecution. I think that's because this guy's just so stupid. You just got to make him pay for his own ignorance. In a plea agreement, prosecutors set aside two other charges of conspiracy to homicide and conspiracy to aggravated assault. State police charged Rauser in February, reporting that he first recruited a fellow inmate at SCI Pine Grove in the mid-2015s to kill a man who testified against him about 7 years earlier. The second inmate told Rauser he located someone to carry out the hit, but at the same time had reported the matter to the state police. According to court records, undercover state trooper Rebecca Fabich took the name Joni Pepperoni.
No.
She's obviously played too many Mario Kart games. I know. I'm going to go undercover. I'm going to be a Joni a Pepperoni. She went undercover for the part and negotiated with Rauser through his girlfriend, Lorraine Patterson. Oh, so there's two geniuses. Rauser relied on his girlfriend, Lorraine, who also didn't sniff out Joni Pepperoni as possibly a false name.
How do you not?
I don't know. Was Paul Meatball out of business or something?
Paul Meatball. Sauce the boss.
Oh, my God.
He's the head of the family.
Patterson, 55, of Sewickley, also was charged in the case, and in May was found not guilty of charges that she acted as a go-between to help Rauser pay someone to take vengeance on Randolph Walters, who testified against him. In trial in Fulton County, Rauser originally had been in prison for 8 to 20 years on charges that he shot and wounded, not wound, he didn't wound up Walters, he shot and wounded him in 2008. According to the charges, Rauser arranged to have Patterson, who befriended Rauser at Pine Grove when she bought a friend to visit another inmate, deliver $5,000 at the kill site. To hire the elite killing force known as Joni Pepperoni.
So how you gonna kill him? I'm gonna kill him with indigestion.
The elite killing force known as Joni Pepperoni charges $5,000 to wax. What a stupid name.
Joni Pepperoni.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is just one of those stories. Oh, okay. All right.
I don't even know how you end up getting the first 100 bucks out of your hand, much less the whole 5,000.
I've heard of the dark web. Did this chick look her up on the dark web? How do you find Joni Pepperoni the hit one? Oh, my God. I'm in the wrong business. I could be making $5,000.
How many clowns were in the car with her when she showed up to the meet? I mean, Joni Pepperoni.
I don't know. Okay. She was supposed to deliver the $5,000 to Joni Pepperoni. At Patterson's trial, jurors heard a recording of a phone conversation.
No.
Between Rauser and an informant, defense attorney Jennifer Soslowski said Patterson had been duped into taking part in the plot and didn't realize the payment was intended for a killing. Patterson believed she was paying a private eye.
Yeah.
A private eye named Joni Pepperoni. Oh, my God. These people are morons.
Joni Pepperoni. a spy.
Patterson believed she was paying a private eye to help locate the crooked jurors in a quest to overturn Rauser's conviction. Similarly, the attorney said Rauser convinced his parents to provide the $5,000 for Patterson to deliver to Joni Pepperoni. Rauser, Mom, Dad, hear me out. I need help, and the only person that can help me is Joni Pepperoni. I need $5,000. Rauser, 49, first demanded a jury trial but pleaded guilty in January to a count of conspiracy to aggravated assault. No wonder he's aggravated.
I'd be aggravated, too.
He then withdrew his plea and again demanded a jury trial. When he appeared for sentencing, at the same time, Judge William Martin denied Rauser's request to consolidate his case with Patterson's for a single trial. In June, Rauser agreed to the plea agreement offered by the district attorney's office.
I wanted to go to jail just so I could die of embarrassment be found again.
He had a hell of a mediator, though, Tim, that helped him put the whole thing down.
Who was the mediator, Dave? Oh, my God. I just said mediator.
These people are just... I can't even. I got to go. I got to move on. Okay. All right. So I should be a little nervous with this news story because our listeners are dicks. I make an announcement, a beautiful announcement on our show last week. Mm-hmm. That through the magic of spitting in a cup, I became a father.
Right.
Through Ancestry.com, I found that I have a lovely daughter I didn't know existed and a 5-year-old grandson.
Uh-huh.
How am I thanked for sharing and opening my heart, Tim? How do my lovely listeners reward me? They go, hey, that? I get an email that says, hey, don't get too excited. Read this story. A Missouri teen reunited with her birth mother, then killed her and burned her body, police say.
Oh, wow.
Thanks for that mixed message.
Yeah.
In an affidavit that reads like gothic fiction, investigators describe this, and I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at the tragedy of this crime. I just, that people are such dicks. I have this beautiful moment in my life where I find a child I never knew I had. We're reunited. We're going to get a chance to meet. Somebody's got fucking rain on the brain. Where's Joni Pepperoni when I need her?
It's so good that you found her, Dave, but she's probably going to turn your life into the burning bed. On the other hand, you know.
Dude, this is like hanging out with Glum. Like, you know. With like the most depressing person on the planet. They just got to shit on every party you've ever had. I mean, I'm going to meet my daughter and I get an article about, well, in an affidavit that reads like gothic fiction, investigators describe how a teen reunited with her birth parent last year on an isolated farm in Missouri, only to be tortured there, forced to crawl through hog pens and have salt rubbed in her wounds, and then finally murdered last month and burned in a fire pit. So happy Father's Day, Dave. Oh, Rebecca Rudd, 39, was arrested Monday by Ozark County Sheriff's deputies and charged, among other crimes, with the first-degree murder of Savannah Leckie, 16, whom she'd given up for adoption at birth. The baby had been taken in by a husband and wife in Minnesota.
Uh-oh.
See, there's more ties, Tim. According to sheriff's documents, raised there nearly all her life, but Savannah's adoptive parents eventually divorced, and by late 2016, the teen was having trouble getting along with her adoptive mother's new boyfriend. Well, in November of 2016, Rudd, who had been in casual contact with the girl for years, agreed to take Savannah back, and she was delivered to Rudd in Ozark County, wrote a sheriff's deputy. As he recounted all the things the girl would subsequently endure. And again, I'm not laughing at the tragedy of this. I'm laughing merely at the fact that some jackass listener just had to poop on my parade, Tim. A truck driver and a volunteer firefighter, Rudd, lived on an 81-acre farm near Theodosia, close to the Arkansas border, miles from the nearest paved road. In photos on Rudd's Facebook feed, Life after reuniting with her daughter appeared idyllic. All baby goats and pretty dresses. She looks just like you, a friend wrote beneath a photo of mother and daughter last December. Which is what everybody keeps writing about the pictures of my daughter and I, Tim. Now I'm going to get more nervous. In June, Rudd announced that the pair had even started a family business, making soap, according to the Ozark County Times. She wanted this so badly. She wrote on Facebook of her daughter, to combine two landmark events, her sweet 16 and the official opening of our Hidden Holler farm soap business. But offline, a sheriff's investigator wrote, the girl's new life was bleak. Savannah has been homeschooled and almost has no social contact, he wrote. She lived, slept, and studied on a property with a generator providing the only electricity and a well pump for water. Rudd and her boyfriend slept in a converted metal building like a barn, the deputy wrote in the affidavit. Savannah slept beside them in a camper with a broken air conditioner. Savannah's inability to adapt to life on the farm became a growing irritant to Rudd, according to the affidavit. Eventually, she worried that the cost of caring for the girl would cost her the farm. It's to the point where I either need more help to care for her or I can do nothing with her, Rudd allegedly wrote to Savannah's adoptive mother in late June, a few weeks before the girl disappeared. On July 18th, Rudd reported a fire burning at the top of a hill on her property. Less than an acre of brush had been burned and firefighters put it out. But when they returned to the family's makeshift living quarters and asked for water, Rudd refused, according to the affidavit. She said Savannah got a small burn in the fire and was laying down and couldn't be disturbed. Rudd wouldn't let anyone close to the girl's camper, the firefighters reported. 2 days later, Rudd called the sheriff's office. Said her daughter disappeared overnight, she reported. Her favorite pillow, blanket, and coloring kit were missing. I think she's a runaway, Rudd said, according to the affidavit. Savannah is blaming herself for the fire. Searchers fanned out across the woods and fields. A helicopter and plane searched from above, and missing posters went out as days passed with no sign. Investigators began to get suspicious. Rudd brought Savannah's computer to the local fire department on July 24th, according to the affidavit, and asked a technician there to examine it. I considered this to be an unusual, considering law enforcement were actually searching for information leading to Savannah's disappearance, a sheriff's deputy wrote. The same day, an ex-boyfriend of Rudd's told investigators he'd seen the girl crawling through hog pens and bathing in ponds before she went missing. The man said Savannah had once cut her arm, an investigator wrote, and Rudd scrubbed the affected area with alcohol and salt on a daily basis as a form of discipline. Rudd and her current boyfriend, Robert Pete Jr., were interviewed at the sheriff's office, according to the affidavit, where the mother allegedly admitted to rubbing salt in Savannah's cut, wrestling the girl in mud in a pig pen, and other severe forms of discipline. But the court were becoming less and less cooperative as the search went on, an investigator wrote. Deputies returned to the farm on August 4th with dogs, state police, and a search warrant. They now suspected that Savannah had never really left the property. The farm looked different that morning, an investigator wrote. Gates and doors that had been open on previous visits were now chained and locked. Sometime after investigators arrived, an affidavit states Rudd and Pete abruptly left the home. They drove for nearly 100 miles to Summersville, Missouri, and married there. On the same day, police combed the farm. Investigators searched carefully around the barn and the camper where Savannah had lived, and the vacant buildings and derelict vehicles that surrounded it. Let's stop for a second, Tim. Why do you think that these two ran off to quickly get married?
Besides, it didn't have the parents' permission. I would say she was pregnant.
No, I'm guessing that you can't be forced to turn on your spouse and admit anything.
Oh, okay. Well, there's that too.
Yeah, I think that's right. It. Investigators searched carefully around the barn and the camper where Savannah had lived and the vacant buildings and derelict vehicles that surrounded it. A few hundred yards from the residence, they found a pile of fresh leaves and branches. The brush pile was speckled with cigarette butts and surrounded by what a deputy described in the affidavit as charred earth. The searchers lifted the brush. A deposit of light ash lay beneath it. In the ash, they sifted out a button imprinted with little ducks and finger bones, vertebrae, and teeth. The bones were human, a forensic investigator in Springfield, Missouri, told the Ozark County Sheriff. They'd been burned at a very high temperature and had deteriorated so badly that she suspected some chemical was used. The sheriff mentioned the Hidden Holler Farm soap-making enterprise, according to the affidavit, and that his deputies had seen drums of chemicals on the property. He mentioned that soap was made with lye, which is highly caustic. That would do it, the forensic investigator said, so the sheriff got a second search warrant. Deputies returned to the farm on August 9th. The goats and the couple's guns had disappeared, they noted. They went back over the property and the ash pile they'd searched before, according to the documents published by the Ozark County Times. Investigators left with a box of girls' clothing, hair, a knife, a meat grinder, and more than 24 bottles of lye. We're dealing with someone who's tried to dispose of evidence, Ozark County Sheriff's Darren Reed told the OzarkFirst.com. Reed didn't immediately return a message about the case. Rudd could not be reached, and it's unclear if she has an attorney. But as investigators studied evidence seized from the farm and continued to investigate this month, they learned that Rudd and her new husband had purchased bus tickets to leave the state. So they asked for an arrest warrant this week. I believe Ms. Rudd deliberately and methodically caused the death of Savannah Leckie and then attempted to conceal it by destroying evidence and her remains by fire, Sheriff's deputy wrote to a judge who signed the request and issued the warrant. Two Greyhound buses were set to leave to Springfield on Monday, according to the affidavit, taking Rudd to Kansas and Pete to Tennessee. The sheriff, Reed, and two deputies drove to the station, arrested Rudd, and returned her to the Ozark County Jail. She was charged Tuesday with first-degree and second-degree murder, fatal abuse of a child, tampering with evidence, and abandoning a corpse. And more charges are forthcoming on any individual that was involved in aiding or tampering in this investigation, Reed wrote in a news release. So that's the charming story my listeners send me, Tim, to cover after finding out that I've been reunited with my birth daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you know I don't love these people as much as you do.
I still love them, Tim. They're just, they're little scamps. Little jerky scamps.
Yeah.
Here's a creepy-ass story. This doesn't even fit under dumb crimes and stupid criminals, but just terrifying. Daycare workers in Delaware stopped a man from walking off with two babies after the stranger shoved his way into a facility and grabbed the two infants, state police said Friday. The man rang the front door at Happy Kids Academy in Newark, pushed a worker to get into the facility. Police spokesman Sergeant Richard Bratt said the man went to the infant room, punched another worker in the face, and picked up two infants, putting one under each arm. When the man tried to leave with the babies, one of the workers stood in front of the door to stop him. Police said the other worker went behind the man and grabbed one baby. The first worker then caught the second baby as the child began slipping from the suspect's arm. The suspect ran from the daycare, punching a car in the parking lot, because, damn it, that's what you got to do when you're on the run, Tim.
Well, yeah.
Bratz said the county police officer saw the man and ordered him to stop walking and show his hands. The man refused to obey the police officer's orders, Bratt said, and one officer shot him with a taser. The man continued to approach the officer, police said, and the officer tripped on a curb and fell backward. The officer again deployed the taser, authorities said, but the man continued to approach the officer. Jesus Christ, it's like Michael Myers, Tim. The officer then hit the man with a baton and was able to take him into custody. Calvin Davis, 47, of Newark, was taken to a hospital for evaluation. When he's released, Brad said Davis will be charged with kidnapping, assault, and other offenses. The injured officer was taken to a hospital. One of the two babies sustained a minor cut. Well, we're glad the children are safe, but what a creepy deal that is.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Tim, we've heard that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, right?
Yep.
Well, what about one that's drunk and been turned in? We're going to go to Fort Myers, Florida, Tim. Florida Highway Patrol troopers arrested a woman Sunday in Fort Myers, Florida, after she crashed into a witness who called 911 to report her reckless driving. WFTX reported that Brittany Sharp, 25, faces charges of driving under the influence, driving under the influence and causing property damage, driving with a suspended license, driving without insurance, and careless whispering. Oh, careless driving, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
FHP troopers said a female witness called to report that Sharp was driving erratically, not erotically, but erratically on the road around 2 p.m. WBBH reported that Suzette Williams, Angelina Powell, and another female passenger followed Sharp for 9 minutes, filming Sharp's vehicle as they broadcast it on Facebook Live. One clip shows Sharp's vehicle barely miss others as it crashed into a bridge wall on the highway. According to news press, a witness said that she pulled her car in front of Sharp when Sharp made a complete stop in the center lane. Sharp then drove her car into the back of the witness's vehicle. Officials took Sharp to the hospital for minor injuries. She remains at the Lee County Jail with no bond set. Jail records show that Sharp was arrested twice this year on charges of larceny and dealing in stolen property. might be time to just tie her to a post and let Irma have its way with her. I don't know. Is that
wow.
too cruel? Well, I'm just saying.
It's slightly medieval of you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I've been reading the Bible. I'm still in the Old Testament. I'm an eye for an eye kind of guy right now. A New Zealand man got so drunk, Tim, he forgot he had sold his car and then contacted police the next day to report it stolen. The man decided to sell his car for New Zealand $800, which is £440, so he could purchase more alcohol on his big night out, but couldn't remember selling the car or his actions the next day. He reported the car missing at Rotorua Police Station, but the case took an unusual turn when the man who purchased it on car selling site CarJam came forward. Thankful at CarJam. Does that sound like the place you want to get a car from?
No.
Stop
no.
on by to CarJam. Get the best deals on the net, and you can help a drunkard have a bigger party. Thankfully, the man who bought the car checked the registration the next day on the CarJam website as he was worried it might be stolen. Sergeant Dennis Murphy told the New Zealand Herald, when the buyer checked the CarJam site, he received an alert about the car possibly being stolen and decided to contact police. The man came into the station with the car to let us know what had happened. We were able to get in touch with the original owner and told them to sort it out between them, Sergeant Murphy added. The lesson here is don't drink and sell cars, Tim. Yeah, that's one of the lessons for damn sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Oh, boy. Deerfield Beach burglary victim arrested after deputies find the devil's lettuce there, Tim. Deerfield Beach, Florida. A Deerfield Beach homeowner is behind bars after police found about 38 pounds of marijuana while responding to a burglary at his house. Anthony Black went before a judge Friday, just one day after his home alarm alerted the Broward Sheriff's County office to check out a disturbance. Road Patrol received a call that there was an alarm activation at a residence, said BSO Detective Michael Wiener. Someone had broken into Black's home, according to the police report. Black, 32... Stop it, Tim. Arrived to find a burglar jumping his fence. When road patrol, stop it. It's like dealing with a five-year-old.
Got caught by a wiener.
Officer Wiener to you, sir. Is that going to be your prison name? Tim, are you going to be Officer Wiener when you go to jail? When road yeah. patrol deputies got there, they went to the back of the house after the resident owner secured a couple of dogs, realized the back window to one of the doors was smashed in. Black secured his pit bulls while deputies entered his home, but the burglary soon took backseat to the officer's latest discovery. BSO Detective Reginald Cleofat. Wow, that's a hell of a name. I'd stick with Officer Wiener if I were him. Said it was the smell of marijuana that caught his attention first. As soon as you walked in, it just hit you in the face. To be honest with you, it was all over the place, said Cleofat. He knew he was caught red-handed. He knew that he'd messed up, to be honest with you. Bags and bags of weed were found all over the house, along with a gun, thousands of dollars. In the end, it was 17,000 grams. That equals about 38 pounds of the devil's lettuce, Tim.
Wow.
Yeah, Satan's cabbage is pricey. Street worth is about $100,000.
You know what?
And $101,000 on the street.
At least for a month.
Black was arrested and taken to jail. I'm not a bad guy, Black said to the judge. He was so focused on the fact that he was a victim of a crime, which was the burglary, said Cleofat. It completely escaped his mind that there were narcotics inside the residence. Yeah, 38 pounds of narcotics. How did you not remember that that's in your home? Some
that's
people are just
lot.
Dumber than dumb can be, Tim.
Yeah.
And as we wrap it up, as we love to talk about politics on the show, Tim. No, we mm-hmm. don't. And we love to talk about dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Let's talk about a dumb crime and a stupid politician, shall we?
All right.
The mayor of Aynor was carrying a beer when he was pulled over while riding a lawnmower through town last month, according to a police dash cam video. You also have an open container, the Horry County police officer said in the video, taken at around 8:30 p.m. on August 25th. I know, and I apologize for that, said John Gardner, who is also the chief financial officer for the Horry County Schools. I like that Gardner is driving on a lawnmower. Works out well.
Yeah.
The officers made Gardner pour out the beer, which Gardner now contends was not open. It was unopened, the best of my knowledge. It was unopened to the best of my knowledge, Gardner said in an interview Friday. I remember opening it just to pour it out. Gardner says he was not cited, and the video shows officers saying they would call the town of Ayner to handle the situation. Gardner, who was elected in 2016 and who is up for re-election this year, said he had put gas in the lawnmower after cutting his mother-in-law's grass and picked up the beer at the gas station. He said he thinks he was pulled over because the lawnmower had no lights. It's just a misunderstanding, he assures us. And that's it for this week's Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals, Tim. How about that?
That's good stuff.
Next week, Steph Young is back with us, Tim. And we're going to be talking about some really weird stuff. The happy face killers, the smiley face killers, I'm sorry, is the topic of next week's show. And then we're going to be reading some of your stories. And we encourage you, send them in to us. We've done this in the past. Do you know a murderer? Are you maybe a survivor of a serial killer? We want to hear your story. You can email it to me at dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com, and we may read it on a future installment of True Crime Tuesday. We've been fascinated by this topic for a while, so next week we're going to share some I Knew a Murderer stories because so many of you have asked for that to return. We're going to interweave that with more Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as the weeks progress. And then in a few weeks, Tim, we're going to actually talk to a gentleman who's written a book on how to kind of de-escalate bad situations. So I think that's an important part. You know, so many of these crimes are because things are just getting out of hand. Well, this guy believes he can teach us how to de-escalate these situations in around 30 seconds. So it might save your life and someone else's. That'll be taking place in a couple of weeks. I think that's going to be, with maybe Neil Story, who's going to be returning, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of creepy things from the Rippers of England to the butchers and demon killers out there, Tim, and ghosts that have haunted and solved their own crimes. Neil Story will be with us in 2 weeks on True Crime Tuesday. How does that sound?
Sounds wonderful, yeah. Actually.
A lot of good stuff taking place. Thank you all for subscribing and supporting us here on the show. We appreciate it. It goes a long way. Please let your friends, relatives, neighbors, coworkers know if they love true crime, they should subscribe right now. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.